Now we go into the next chapter, the 18th chapter. This is a short chapter, only 7 verses. But it's only short in that sense, because it is one of the most difficult prophecies in the whole Bible, according to some of the Bible scholars, to make an application and to get an understanding of. So we tread this ground lightly, knowing that we're on dangerous ground, and knowing also that the applications that we make here may not be the right applications, but nevertheless, they do seem to be the things that seem to fit. This is a prophecy written to a country that we're not sure which country it is. It says, which is beyond the rivers of Ethiopia. And so, my Bible says that it's a prophecy about Ethiopia sending a present to Jehovah. But we don't know for sure that this is talking about the country of Ethiopia. Let's look, though, at what it does say. Woe to the land shadowing with wings, which is beyond the rivers of Ethiopia. The words woe here do not necessarily mean woe in the same sense of a rueful or dangerous situation, but it could mean woe in the sense of calling to their attention, like ho or hey. Now, to the land, this is to the land shadowing with wings. And here's a description that has defied many commentators and translators and Bible scholars as to what this is, the land shadowing with wings. And we have about a dozen different things that this could mean. Shadowing with wings could mean a herd of locusts that are so thick that when they fly, that they blot out the sun from the land. And this word shadowing not only means a shadow or the blotting out of the sun, but it also means to make a certain kind of a noise, like locusts would make. It could mean the sails of a big sailing vessels as they go by with commerce casting a shadow on the land. It could mean birds. It could mean many different things. And so it's real difficult to say just what it is. But the description of the sailing vessels would fit that area that would be beyond the rivers of Ethiopia. Now, we don't know which waters this is, which river this is, or rivers these are, that would be the rivers of Ethiopia, but it is probably the river that's called Cush, which was, of course, Cush was the son of Noah, that whose descendants did inhabit Ethiopia. And the most probable place for this to be is either going to be Upper Egypt. Now, as we look at Egypt, as we think of Egypt, Egypt, you know, borders on the Mediterranean Sea. The Nile River runs through it. That part where the Nile empties into the Mediterranean is Lower Egypt. And then the part further south is Upper Egypt. And as we look at Upper Egypt and the river then that runs across it and the other side of that river, we have Ethiopia. So it would be either be Upper Egypt or the land beyond that area known as Ethiopia. In all probability, it is Upper Egypt. So this would be a portion of Egypt. And back during this time, Egypt was divided into many different segments, which we're getting more of in the next chapter. Some 42 districts at one time. At one time, they had 12 different kings ruling at one time. And so this is a portion of that nation. And he further describes in verse 2, that sendeth ambassadors by the sea. This nation was a nation that sent ambassadors by the sea. It doesn't tell us who they sent the ambassadors to, what the purpose of it was, whether this was a one-time sending of the ambassadors, or whether it was an habitual thing characterizing this nation. But they did send ambassadors by the sea, even in vessels of bulrushes upon the waters. Now, these vessels of bulrushes were vessels that were made of a plant, the papyrus plant that grew by the waters there in that part of the country. And this particular plant only grew in a certain part of the world over there in Egypt. So it pretty well pinpoints where the area was. And they made their vessels of that. And there's many different ways this could be interpreted. Some have even interpreted that they made a lot of pottery and put a raft on the pottery and floated it down the river. And this is did happen in Egypt during this time. But they sent these ambassadors on the sea in these vessels made of the bulrushes. And you know, bulrushes are also the kind of plant that was used to make a little boat or canoe that Moses was put in. And we think that's a strange way to make a vessel, but the American Indian in this country made their vessels of a similar nature, of trees and of barks of trees. Saying, and let's note right here that the word saying is not in the original manuscript. It's only in italics, and it probably changes and destroys the true meaning of this verse. Go, ye swift messengers, to a nation scattered and peeled, to a people terrible from their beginning hitherto, a nation meted out and trodden down, whose land the rivers have spoiled. Here again we run into difficulties, but what this verse probably means is that those messengers that were sent out by that nation were then given a message and sent back by God to deliver this message to their own people. Because the word saying is not in there. And so he's simply saying, after giving a description of these ambassadors in these vessels, go, ye swift messengers. Then he describes the nation that they go to, which is this nation that we're talking about. And here's the description of it. To a nation scattered and peeled. Now, these words leave a lot of unsaid things. The word scattered here really means spread. And it probably means a nation that has enlarged its boundaries by overrunning other nations, or a nation that runs along a long area of land, one that's not bunched up in one little small place. They're scattered and peeled. Now, the word peeled can mean several things. It means one thing, to be sheared, to have the hair cut off, indicating that the people in this area wore their hair short. The men did, and shaved. They were peeled. Or it could mean that they didn't wear very many clothes. And some have even interpreted this to be a certain pygmy that lived in that area, which I don't really know that means that at all. And it also, this word peel can mean preparing of certain implements for battle, so that they could be a warlike people, and they had spread themselves and they had armed themselves. So it's a little difficult to get the full meaning of that. He further describes them, to a people terrible from their beginning hitherto. And the word terrible means warlike. To a people that are warlike from their beginning hitherto. That is, their earliest beginnings as a nation was founded upon the fact that they were a warlike people and they were a conquering nation. A nation meted out and trodden down. Now here we have another difficult area. Meted out and trodden down. This word meted means to draw lines or to measure. And some have interpreted it to mean that it was a nation that had many laws. They constantly were bombarded by their rulers making laws for them. Others have said, no, it's a nation that has enlarged itself so much that they've had to spend a lot of time in surveying the land and drawing lines and surveying their land and measuring out new parcels of land. And others have taken that and interpreted it to mean that they have been a very conquering nation and they're continually enlarging and drawing new boundaries as they conquer other nations. But a nation meted out and trodden down. And the words here, trodden down, really mean that they were the ones doing the trodding and not the ones being trodden upon. So as they would conquer other nations, they would trod the other nations. And they were in the habit then of measuring out and trodding down. This was characteristic of the people here. Whose land the rivers have spoiled. Now if it is Upper Egypt is a land through which the Nile had its beginning, And the Nile River, as it flowed from the upper Egypt to lower Egypt, it would carry the soil from upper Egypt down to lower Egypt and there flood out lower Egypt and deposit the soil there and enrich their land. So upper Egypt was being robbed by the river while lower Egypt was being made rich by the river. And so that could be the meaning here, whose land the rivers have spoiled, washing away the land. Now in verse 3, as he sends this message back to this nation that he has described here, and he's given some very graphic descriptions of it, if we only could just pinpoint what nation it is, in all probability it is Upper Egypt. All ye inhabitants of the world and dwellers on the earth, see ye. Now, God is calling all the world to witness what's going to happen, what he's going to say about this nation. All ye inhabitants, all ye dwellers, see ye. When he lifteth up an ensign on the mountains, and when he bloweth a trumpet, hear ye. The question in this third verse is, who is lifting up the ensign on the mountains, and who is blowing the trumpet? As they observed the activities, and this this could be this nation doing this, it could be God allowing them to carry on the activities that they'd been doing, and we've already seen that they were a warlike nation. We've already seen that they were a fierce people from the very beginning, a nation that made it out and trotted down. Well, as they then are lifting up an ensign on the mountains, that is, as they're calling forth to battle, and as they're blowing the trumpet, which would also be another call to battle or a preparation for war, the Lord says, hear ye. Now, what's going to happen while this is going on? Verse 4. For so the Lord said unto me, now this apparently is the Lord speaking now to Isaiah, I will take my rest, and I will consider in my dwelling place like a clear heat upon herbs, and like a cloud of dew in the heat of harvest. Now the Lord says, I'm not going to interfere with these people while they're making these preparations for war. Rather than interfere, I'm going to take my rest. The Lord, you know, once he has a plan, and once he gives forth a prophecy, then he can sit back and he can watch those who try to work against his plan and work against his prophecy. He can sit back and take his rest, and knowing how he's going to cause things to turn out, he doesn't have to work and fight against the people. He lets them go until he's ready then to take action. So I'll take my rest and I'll consider in my dwelling place. Now his dwelling place is heaven. I'll just stay in heaven and I'll consider there in my dwelling place, like a clear heat upon herbs. Now the clear heat upon herbs is like the sun shining on plants. And it is as though these people in this nation were plants. And they were working according to the way God had thought they would. And so he sends the sunshine on the herbs to make the herbs grow. Let them go ahead and grow and flourish. You know, Jesus said he sendeth the rain on the just and the unjust, and the sun on the good and the bad. God seems to equally distribute these things to people. Well, here he is sitting in his dwelling place. He's resting. He's considering. And he's sending the clear heat on the herbs. And and like a cloud of dew in the heat of harvest, he also sends the dew on them, so that they seem to be thriving according to the natural laws, not realizing, not knowing the fate that God has in store for them. For the harvest, now before time comes for the harvest, when the bud is perfect and the sour grape is ripening in the flower, just when the time came when it looked like they were going to be so successful in their endeavors, he shall both cut off the sprig with the pruning hook and take away and cut down the branches. Not only is he going to take the fruit, But he's also going to cut the sprigs and the branches so that they won't be able to bear any future fruit. Oh, he sent the sunshine and the rain, and he didn't interfere. He let them go. But nevertheless, when time came, then God did intervene. And so they're going to be in verse 6, they shall be left together unto the fowls of the mountains and to the beasts of the earth. And the fowl shall summer upon them, and all the beasts of the earth shall winter upon them. So they're going to be left to the wild beasts. They're going to be left together, he says, to the fowls of the mountains and to the beasts of the earth. Now the fowls are going to summer on them, and the beasts are going to winter upon them, so that their destruction is going to be of such a large scale that they'll be able to supply these wild beasts not only in the summer but also in the winter. Now, what's going to be the result of that? In that time shall the present be brought unto the Lord of hosts of a people scattered and peeled, and from a people terrible from their beginning hitherto. This is the same description given in verse 2 now. A nation meted out and trodden underfoot, whose land the rivers have spoiled. Well, he says that this nation is going to bring a present to the Lord of hosts. And they're going to bring the present to the place of the name of the Lord of hosts, the Mount Zion. Now, there have been a lot of interpretation as to what it means about this present. What is the present? When was it brought? By whom was it brought? Where was it brought? What is the present? Well, there have been several understandings. One is that after this nation was brought low, that many of its people did actually turn to God. Many Jews did settle and inhabit in that land, and they had quite a following among the Jews. And even in later years, whenever the church was established, there were some Christians also who flourished in this area. Mohammedanism never did take a very good hold in this region, not nearly so much as there's evidence that Christianity did. Now, was this the present he's talking about that would be brought to the Lord as a result of his judgment placed upon them? It's possible, but it's only conjecture. I don't know. Another interpretation of this is that in this verse 3, where he talks about all ye inhabitants of the world and dwellers of the earth, see ye when he lifted up an ensign on the mountains, and when he bloweth the trumpet, hear ye, that there he's talking about Sennacherib as he is invading Judea, and it looks like that he's going to invade the rest of the world. He's going to surely conquer Judea and come on down and take all of Egypt. That they're seeing this thing happen. God let it happen. He let it get right up to the time of harvest, whenever the grape was just ready to be plucked, and then God intervened and didn't let them have the fruit. That then as a result of that, as this nation of Upper Egypt saw Sennacherib defeated, then they rejoiced and they brought a present to God to celebrate that event. Now, to verify that, and this is the position that Mr. Clark takes, we look in 2 Chronicles 32, verses 22 and 23. And here we have the account of the celebrating that was done when the Lord saved Hezekiah and his country from Sennacherib. 2 Chronicles 32, beginning with verses 22 and 23. Thus the Lord saved Hezekiah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem from the hand of Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, and from the hand of all other, and guided them on every side. Now verse 23. And many brought gifts unto the Lord to Jerusalem, and presents to Hezekiah, king of Judah, so that he was magnified in the sight of all nations from thenceforth. So some of the commentators are saying that this description of them bringing the gifts to the Lord to Jerusalem and bringing presents to Hezekiah and causing the Lord to be magnified in the sight of all nations from thenceforth. That then is what he's talking about when he says that in that time shall the present be brought unto the Lord of hosts. And then he says it'll be to the place of the name of the Lord of hosts, the Mount Zion, which would be Jerusalem. So that they reason this way, that surely there were many nations who were rejoicing in that, and then there were certainly some of those from this nation in Isaiah 18 who were there representing their country and bringing gifts, or bringing presents, or a present, to celebrate the overthrow of the Assyrian army. And here again, we don't know for sure, but it's interesting to see some of the ramifications and applications here. But as we said before we began, this is a short chapter in number of verses, but it's not a short chapter when you start trying to really make an application of all that it's saying. And some of the noted commentators have described it as one of the most difficult prophecies in the Bible, this 18th chapter of Isaiah. We're not going to have really time to get into the 19th chapter of Isaiah, but I would like to give a little preview in the next few minutes here of this 19th chapter. The 19th chapter is a prophecy about Egypt.